MacCast, Monday, March 2nd, 2015. This episode of the MacCast is brought to you by lynda.com. Invest in yourself and sign up for a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/MacCast. And by Gazelle. Want cash now for your old devices? You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, Mac, or even Android devices are worth by going to gazelle.com. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, as always, February slipped by, and here we are in March, and right around the corner, we've got a big announcement coming up from Apple next week. So we're going to be talking about that in this episode. I bet you can guess what that might be about. Let's just say it's time related. Also, more rumors and updates on the Apple Car or what they might be doing in that space. Some updates to maybe Touch ID. Also, some stuff happening over in Europe with Apple Pay. We've got that, plus some great feedback from you. Apple has acknowledged a display issue. We're going to talk a little bit about consolidating your iTunes library on an external device, and cleaning up iPhone contacts, along with some follow-up on some tips about selling your old devices and how you can keep those safe and maybe even track them while they're in transit. All of that and a whole lot more coming up in this episode of the MacCast. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is lynda.com. Well, we're already a couple months into the new year, and I would say now is a perfect time to start expanding your tech skills, maybe learn something completely new, and lynda.com is a perfect place to start. They have over 3,000 video courses and tutorials on things like web development, photography, visual design, even business, and all of their courses, something I love about Lynda is that all of their courses are taught by experts, and they're constantly adding new courses every week. So whether you want to set up some new financial goals for yourself, you're looking for a little bit better work-life balance, maybe you want to invest more heavily in a new hobby, or you're looking to get a raise or maybe find a new job or improve upon some of your current skill sets this year, lynda.com has something for everyone. One of the things I love about them is that they cover all different skill levels. So they have everything from intro courses on iOS 8 to office level courses. They even have inspirational courses. So if you're just looking for a little bit of extra inspiration in the job you do, they have things like that. If you're looking to get more performance, speed up, maintain your Mac, all the way through high-end programming things. They have a Swift Essentials training course. So if you're looking to learn about Apple's latest programming language, they have that there as well. And something I always try to do is check out the new courses that are coming, because they're updated weekly and they have a special section for that. So they make it really easy to get in there, find out what's new. As a matter of fact, just this week I saw that they have a new jQuery creating plugins course. This is something I've had to do for my programming efforts in the past, and it's something I've struggled with. Creating jQuery plugins is not all that simple. It can be, but you get into little ruts and little issues along the way. And so I've added this course to my list. You can set up a course list so you can keep track of the things that you want to learn, and it's all there in your account. That's why, to me, Lynda is so valuable. It allows you to keep learning. I mean, we never stop learning. We're constantly wanting to have new opportunities to expand our skills, learn something new, and they provide that. And best of all, you can sign up for a free 10-day trial by visiting lynda.com/MacCast to check it out. You get unlimited access to every course on lynda.com. You have access to the tutorials on your iPhone, your tablet, your Android devices. And like I said, they're always updating and adding new stuff. So invest in yourself this year. Sign up for a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by visiting lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. Go ahead. I challenge you to learn something new in 2015. And a big thank you to Lynda for their continued support of the MacCast. So as I said at the top of the show, Apple has the Apple Watch coming, or at least we believe it's the Apple Watch. Apple this week sent out invites for what they're calling their spring forward event. And if there's not enough hints about time and time changes and springs and watches and anything in just those two little words, I don't know how else they could make it more obvious. The timing certainly fits in with what we're expecting for a launch of the watch. The event is happening on Monday, March 9th at 10 a.m. Pacific time. They're going to hold it at the Yerba Buena Center for the Arts in San Francisco, a venue that they've used many times in the past. And good news for those of us who didn't get an invite and won't be flying out to San Francisco to attend, they are going to be live streaming the event. Of course, all the Mac and Apple blogs will be live blogging and tweeting and what have you. And I thought this would be a good time to remind you, too, that on the days when Apple is making announcements and streaming the stuff, I try to set up a MacCast IRC chat. So I'll put details for that up at maccast.com on the 9th. So go there in the morning. I'll also tweet them out. So if you're following me on Twitter, you'll get that information. And it's just kind of fun to hang out with other members of the MacCast community and sort of watch things as they unfold live, and we can comment on them in our sort of back channel IRC. So if you'd like to take advantage of that, again, be watching the feed or maccast.com, and we'd love to have you join us. But once again, also at the event, Apple appears to be building a mysterious white structure next to the venue, kind of a tented structure. I think just like when they announced the Apple Watch, again, it's believed to be the hands-on demo area for members of the press. So they'll do the event in the Yerba Buena Center and then kind of usher everybody out to the hands-on area. I don't know if that means they're inviting more journalists. I would suspect that they are, because you're going to have people not just from the tech community, but also from the fashion community and the health and fitness, probably medical community. It's going to be a broad range of folks. It's going to be interesting to see who's there covering the event. Now, the Wall Street Journal recently ran a report saying that Apple had hoped to have more health features inside the watch, but those features were cut before the announcement. Now, it's not a surprise to you and I who've been following the rumors leading up to Apple's announcement. And to be very clear, what they're talking about here is some of the features that they were hoping to get in the watch before they made the announcement. This is not stuff that has been cut since the announcement. As far as we know, none of the features that Apple showed off already at their announcement event for the Apple Watch have been removed. And some reports were kind of misleading on that or getting the facts wrong at that. So if you happen to see a story and it seemed like Apple was cutting features, they're not cutting features now. This was all pre. And I think it was because many of the sensors that they were looking at were more medical related, things like blood pressure monitors, stress level monitors, glucose sensors that could get glucose levels through skin contact. These were kind of advanced sensors. And what ultimately happened, I think, as Apple was doing the R&D, and this is just my sort of take on it, was that it added a lot of complexity. We had been hearing reports that some of these sensors might require FDA or governmental approvals, which would slow down the process. And, you know, I would imagine cost of the sensors and just the volume and battery life and a bunch of things went in to say, you know what, there were some technical issues, there were governmental regulatory issues, and it just proved to be too much of a hassle. I'm assuming there was also, or we also heard some reports that there were some reliability issues, and maybe some of the sensors just weren't accurate enough or reliable enough to make the cut for launch. So Apple scaled back so they could get the product out there. It has more of a health and fitness focus, more so than a medical focus. I think ultimately, though, if you look at HealthKit and all the things that that can monitor, Apple's really looking to the future, and I would fully expect future generations of the Apple Watch to be more focused on deeper health-related integrations. But for now, we have what Apple has announced and probably some new things that they're going to show us at this event. One of those new things might also be that the watch is a little bit more water-resistant than we first thought, maybe even waterproof, although I think that's going a bit too far. Reportedly, Apple's chief executive, Tim Cook, was overheard telling an Apple retail employee in Germany, he was recently on a trip over there, saying that he wears his Apple Watch in the shower, which is a little bit more water than I think we had thought it could handle just based on the original announcement. It sounded like it was going to be able to be, you know, splashed on, but not necessarily submerged. And if you're wearing it in the shower, it's going to get pretty wet. So heavy downpour, rainstorm. I don't know if that means it's going to be fully waterproof. Can you go swimming with it? Probably not. But it does seem to indicate that Apple might have some new surprises or additional advancements to tell us about when they make the launch. Another thing Cook was reportedly saying came from The Telegraph. They said that the company designed the Apple Watch to replace things like electronic car keys and fobs. And exactly how they're going to do that wasn't revealed, but maybe through some of their partnerships with the automakers, you'll be able to use your Apple Watch to actually start up your car, things like that, if you have obviously a supported system. But I'm sure we'll get more on that at this launch event. Another thing that's been talked about and speculated for a long time is the battery life in the Apple Watch. It's pretty much understood from statements made by Tim Cook and others that at this point it's going to be a daily charger for most people. So you'll be able to get with regular usage through about 19, maybe 20 hours of usage, and then it will need to be charged. But now we're hearing that there might possibly be a way built in to extend the battery life, something called a power reserve mode. Brian X. Chen of the New York Times claimed that Apple has developed the yet-to-be-announced feature, and it would be a mode that would allow the watch to run on very low energy but only display the time. Now, while that sounds cool and maybe we'll be able to get a day, more than a day of battery life out of it, I'm kind of feeling that it somewhat, in some ways, defeats the point, right? What's the point of it just doing the time? I could get a cheap, you know, $15 watch to do that. I guess if you're nearing the end of the day and you want to turn off the rest of the features and just have a wristwatch for the rest of the day, I guess maybe it makes sense. But I have a feeling most of us are just going to charge it every day and it's really not going to be a problem. Now, if the thing hits the street and it starts to fall short of that full day usage, I think we're going to be hearing about it, and you'll hear it from me, too. I'll probably be complaining if my Apple Watch isn't making it through at least one day of usage. Regardless, though, it's looking like the Apple Watch is going to be a big hit, or at least Apple is predicting it to be a pretty big hit. Reports are indicating Apple is looking to have about 5 to 6 million Apple Watch units ready to go on sale at launch. It's believed that Quanta Computer is going to be the sole assembler of the Apple Watch. And just to put things in perspective, 5 to 6 million units, I think that's about the range that Apple had for the original iPad launch. So they're expecting it to be possibly at least as popular as the original iPad. Pricing is another thing that's been up in the air beyond the $349 US Apple Sport model. Rumors are still all over the board regarding price. The Apple Watch, that's the stainless steel and sapphire glass version, it's believed that one might fall in the price range somewhere between $500 and $1,000 US. The gold Apple edition watch, that has a huge speculative price range. I've heard as low as maybe $3,000 up to maybe as high as $15,000. And I would imagine it's going to have a lot to do with the amount of gold content that's in there. Another thing that may impact the price when you're picking yours up at the Apple Store is those bands. And there's something I'm calling the great band debate. And that is, will Apple offer all of the different bands as separate accessories that you can mix and match with the different watch models? Or is it going to be limited by which choice of watch you get? So some folks are saying if you get the Apple Watch, it's going to have certain band combinations that come with it. If you get the Edition, that's going to have specific band combinations, and the Sport, the same token. I'm more in the camp where I think Apple is going to have bands as accessories. I think there's going to be different models that come in the box with different combinations, but then I fully expect them to be selling all the different bands, and you'll be able to buy a secondary band, mix and match. I don't think there's anything proprietary about the clasp mechanism. As a matter of fact, this past week, I think we saw a Kickstarter come out that was going to have a little adapter that would allow you to use more standard bands to attach to your Apple Watch. Whether or not Apple will allow that Who really knows? We'll have to wait and see on that. But a lot of speculation circling around the bands. And as far as pricing on the bands, those are all over the board as well. I've heard some rumors that some bands may be more costly than the Apple Sport Edition watch itself. So imagine a band costing $300, $400, $500. I've even heard $1,500 for things like the Milanese Loop or maybe the stainless steel link bands, things like that. That seems crazy to me, but I've been told by folks who are watch collectors and high-end watch people that that's not out of the realm of possibility. So I guess have your wallet fully stacked with bills when you head into your Apple store to pick up your Apple Watch. And no word on whether or not they're going to do pre-orders. We don't really know, but I guess we're going to find out on the 9th and have a lot more answers by then. And of course, we'll be talking about that on future episodes of the MacCast. Now, one thing we do know is that Apple is putting a heavy fashion spin on the Apple Watch. We've seen it showing up in photos and articles and pieces and in photo spreads in top fashion magazines all over the world. And there are reportedly going to be big changes in how Apple is going to sell and market the Apple Watch. It's going to be much different than anything Apple has ever done before. As a matter of fact, the New Yorker detailed a collaboration between Apple's design chief, Johnny Ive, and their head of retail, Angela Arendts. They are redesigning Apple's retail stores supposedly to create an experience better suited to selling the Apple Watch. The piece alluded to something called a VIP area. I don't know if that's only going to be for the high-end watches or if that's an experience that every customer coming into an Apple store is going to get. But also they noted a comment by Ive saying that he heard that people wouldn't buy a watch or some people wouldn't buy a watch from a store if they weren't standing on carpet, which could be a problem because if you've ever been into an Apple retail store, they're generally all hardwood floors or maybe even just polished concrete floors. I think they all have hardwood floors, but I haven't been to every Apple store all over the world, so don't take my word on that. But in general, they don't have a lot of carpet from what I remember in Apple stores. Will that change? Who knows? It sounds like it may if there are actually watch people who won't buy a watch if they're not standing on carpet. I don't get that, but if you're a watch person, maybe you can explain it to me. I'm not sure what that's all about. And we'd already heard that there were possibly things like new seating areas coming to some Apple stores. So really different design experience. And that's going to be challenging for Apple because they are limited on retail space at many of those locations. So it'll be interesting to see how they handle that. Now, we're also hearing about a change that's not directly related to the Apple Watch, but is a change for the Apple retail stores, and that is something that might be happening at the Genius Bar. Supposedly, there's a new initiative dubbed Concierge, although I thought we had a concierge service as part of the Genius Bar way back when, and then it went away. Maybe it's coming back, or maybe they're just bringing back something with the same name. Sounds like they are in that it's going to be a little bit of different service, but it's saying it's going to be rolled out starting the week of March 9th, and it's going to replace Apple's walk-in appointment program. I think a lot of people didn't know that Apple actually had a walk-in appointment program. Most folks went on the Apple website and kind of you set up your time, and sometimes, depending on the store, it could be days or maybe even weeks in advance before you could get in. And that was always a hassle. So you can walk into an Apple retail store, or at least you will be able to supposedly after the week of the 9th and take advantage of this new concierge service. What's supposed to happen is that Apple store employees will have an algorithm-driven iPad app, and they will assess and assign priority access and wait times to customers based on what their issue is and sort of get them queued up for walk-ins. And then what happens is you'll get an alert on your phone, an iMessage, that will have an update on your wait time. So initially you'll get a message confirming the appointment and letting you know how long you're going to have to wait before your appointment. Then you'll get a text message letting you know, hey, you need to come back to the Apple store. So I think since a lot of Apple stores are in malls and in retail locations, you can go off and shop or maybe get a bite to eat while you're waiting for your walk-in appointment. And then finally, once you're back at the Apple store, you'll get a message letting you know when the technician is ready to help you out. And as a matter of fact, I already had this experience with my last The last time I went in to access the Genius Bar, I wasn't able to get an appointment, but I was in the area. I walked in and I had this exact experience. So I don't know how this new service is different, or maybe I just got lucky and was at an Apple store where they were testing out this new service and now they're getting ready to roll it out everywhere. But that sounds like a great experience, customer experience for accessing the Genius Bar. But let's get back to the Apple Watch, because I think that's what a lot of us are most excited about. So we've got the event coming. The last question that's probably going to be answered that at that event is, when and where can we get the Apple Watch? And 9to5Mac claimed that Tim Cook, in that trip to Germany, also told a group of employees in Berlin that the Apple Watch will be available in countries other than the U.S., starting in April, and that includes Germany. Of course, he didn't give an exact date, and it's not clear if it's going to be a simultaneous rollout. It's believed that the Apple Watch will hit retail in the U.S. sometime in early April, and that maybe the other countries will follow on a few weeks later. I'm guessing, though, with the volume that we're hearing Apple is planning on shipping, that Apple is going to do a simultaneous global rollout. And I would imagine there's going to be a pretty good complement of countries in the North America region, Europe, Asia, Australia. I think Apple's going to spread the love around on this one, because I think they're going to want to get as many Apple Watches out into the market as quickly as possible. It's going to show good numbers for their quarterly results following the Apple Watch announcement and prove to a lot of the naysayers that Apple really is still on top. They can innovate and disrupt and create new markets and new demands. And I think I'm not going out on a limb saying the Apple Watch, I think, is going to make a huge splash and Apple's going to have awesome numbers. Now, as far as what the experience is going to be and how consumers are going to react, I'm excited about it, but I'm also cautious. You know, this is the first version of a new product, and I'm sure there's going to be little bumps and hiccups in the road, and we should expect those. It's just going to matter how severe those are and how Apple manages those. But very excited. We're probably less than a month away from getting our Apple Watches. So what do you think? As far as what I'm going to get, it's still up in the air for me. I would love to have the stainless steel and sapphire edition, but price point, I think, is going to be a big one for me. I think I've talked about this on other shows, but not really so much on the MacCast. I think for me, because it's a version one product, and I would fully expect that the second edition of the Apple Watch is going to be even more amazing, and I'm going to want that, that I may hold back and just stick with the entry-level sport model. But again, passion and excitement could take over when I actually hear what the actual thing is. But if it gets up much over $500 for the stainless steel and sapphire edition, that's going to be a hard sell for me. But as you know, I'm apt to change my mind, too, once I get the Apple fever going. And I think a lot of us suffer from that. So we'll have to wait and see. But very excited about what's going to be happening on Monday, March 9th. And we'll be there talking about it and following up. Now let's talk about this other thing, this funky rumor that Apple may be developing a car. And this all started with these weird, strange vans that a number of places started reporting seeing, and they looked it up. I think Colorado was one of the first places, I don't remember. And they saw these vans driving around. They had all this equipment, like radar or LIDAR on them, all kinds of stuff, these cameras pointed on all the corners. And someone did a little back checking and found that, hey, these cars, or these vans rather, were leased to Apple. And immediately someone said that, hey, Apple is working on a self-driving car effort. There were other reports that maybe it was part of a mapping effort. And as a matter of fact, when I was in Florida a couple weeks ago or a week and a half ago, I actually saw one of these vans driving around. Unfortunately, it was behind me and I didn't get a picture, but for sure it was one of these weird vans, and I can only assume it was one of the ones that Apple has. So I think this is really part of a mapping effort, at least the van thing. And it was recently also reported that Apple has added a couple new data providers to Apple Maps, GasBuddy and Great Schools, as Maps partners. It looks like they're getting just address data, not, you know, pricing data from GasBuddy or other information from Great Schools, but just kind of confirming, hey, yeah, we've got the right location. So I think this is all part of Apple beefing up their map efforts. We also heard or can now see that Apple has added these cool animated elements to the 3D flyover view in Apple Maps. Specifically, they added an animated version of the London Eye and Big Ben in the UK. And what's cool about the Big Ben thing is it actually shows the current time in London, which is really neat. And if you go check it out, it's kind of cool to look at. The London Eye is obviously more impressive because you actually see it going around. With Big Ben, it doesn't have a second hand, so you got to wait a minute and you'll see the time change. But still cool stuff, and I'm curious to see how Apple expands that functionality. I'm not sure how practical or useful it is, but it's certainly some good eye candy, and Apple's always good at giving that to us. But it just shows Apple is really looking to improve their maps and add new features. And I think a big loss for a lot of us was Street View when Google Maps was replaced by Apple Maps. So I'm thinking these vans are all about bringing back a Street View level sort of functionality into Apple Maps. And I find that a lot more valuable than, say, the flyover view, even though the flyover view is visually really cool and impressive to show off to somebody when, hey, look at Apple Maps, look at these cool 3D models. And they're expanding those cities pretty quickly as well. If you haven't been on and done the flyovers and the tours and stuff like that, that's fun to do as well. But that's what I think the vans are about. Now let's get back to this, are they developing a car debate? And regardless of what's happening with those strange fans, I think it's pretty obvious that there's mounting and convincing evidence that Apple is working on some sort of car project, at least doing R&D in this area. As a matter of fact, Apple is being sued by a battery manufacturing company, A123 Systems, for supposedly poaching their employees. And what does A123 Systems do? Well, it creates advanced nanophosphate, lithium-ion phosphate batteries and energy storage systems, among other things, for vehicle manufacturers. So definitely in the car space. So why is Apple hiring all these automobile engineers? And some people could say, well, you know, you've got a lot of people in that field that are focused on design, but you start looking at these hires and they're coming from Ford and Mercedes-Benz and Tesla and a bunch of other auto and auto-related companies, and they cover all kinds of disciplines, not just design, but also engineering. You got people who are focused on transmissions, on safety systems, on battery technology. Apple's even hiring from the aerospace industry and more. So if you don't think that they're working on some sort of car project, I think you're not, you know, looking at all of the evidence coming in. And they're all supposedly working under the leadership of a former Ford executive, Steve Sadesky, and he is now an Apple product design vice president. So they're putting this team together. They're obviously up to something. The Mac Observer also found evidence that Apple recently made a change to its corporate documents over in Switzerland. They've added some language that says vehicles are part of their business operation. Now, if you look at the specific language and wording, it does also mention that aftermarket parts and accessories for vehicles are part of that. So it's not necessarily a smoking gun. But again, more evidence adding fuel to this fire that Apple is doing something with automobiles. What's really up to debate is exactly what they're doing and to what degree. And I'm going to say, let's not let that stop us. I mean, because when has it ever? Let's not let that stop us from making a bunch of speculation and thinking about this thing a little bit. The project is supposedly codenamed Titan, and Apple supposedly has about 200 people currently working on the project that seems to be expanding. Speculation as far as what the scope is ranges from, hey, they're just working on more in-car infotainment systems, something along the lines of expanding their CarPlay technology, all the way through to they're doing a full-blown autonomous driving electric vehicle. And I say, why stop there? Maybe they're working on flying cars. Now, that hasn't been rumored at all, but I mean, why not? It could be just as extreme as that. It's believed, though, that what Apple is really doing, by most of the reports I've been coming across, that they're working on developing some sort of electric vehicle, possibly exploring some autonomous features, or probably more likely computer-assisted driving systems. So maybe not full-blown autonomous cars, but technologies related to that, maybe eventually leading up to that. It's also been speculated that Johnny Ive's friend, Mark Newsom, might have some involvement in the design. Many articles I read pointed to some concepts that he had done for Ford, and that could be a potential design Apple might be looking at in expanding on and sort of bringing into this Apple Car project. And really, at this point, to me, in looking at all the evidence, it seems this is likely just a huge and very large R&D project for Apple. And what's cool about it is, even if nothing comes of it, if you look at the kinds of technology that Apple is investigating here and the applications of that technology, even if they don't end up developing a full-blown car, they're going to have a lot of R&D put into things like computer vision, voice control systems, battery technology, display technology, entertainment and navigation systems, software. All of that stuff can go back into their core business. So, some are kind of throwing it out there and questioning Apple's desire or ability to really successfully enter the car market. As a matter of fact, a former GM CEO, Dan Akerson, said, you know, in the car industry, we take steel and raw steel and turn it into a car. They, meaning Apple, have no idea what they're getting into if they're planning on getting into that. And when I read this, I thought, you know, this sounds very similar to some of the things we heard another industry say when Apple announced that they would be entering their market. And of course, I'm talking about the mobile phone industry, and we know how that turned out. So I think Apple's already proven their ability to go into a market that they've never been in before and really innovate, iterate, and also deliver products that consumers want. And there's more and more evidence that, especially in the electric car market, that technology companies are better poised than automobile manufacturers to actually really make an impact. And I think that's because they're not bogged down by all of the old systems and dogma and culture that, you know, car manufacturers are. So I think Apple has a real ability to actually pull this off and make an impact. But like I said, even if they don't, they're going to have some amazing technologies come out of that that have applications in other parts of their business. And, you know, why would Apple even want to get into the car business? And Gene Munster pointed out some numbers that, again, make it look very much like why Apple wanted to get into the cell phone market. And that's because this is a huge market, and gaining just a small percentage of it would have a good impact on Apple's bottom line. Munster looked at the numbers and determined that the U.S. car market generates about $500 billion in sales per year. So if Apple could grab just 10% of the U.S. market, that would generate about $50 billion in revenue. And he says that would be a moderate success. And I'm looking at that number saying, well, what about 1%? I think that was what Steve Jobs originally announced Apple was gunning for when they made the iPhone announcement, 1% of the cell phone market. So apply that to the U.S. car market. If Apple could get just 1% of that, that would still be $5 billion in revenue. And in Q1 2015, Apple made just shy of, I think, about $7 billion in revenue from Macs. So 1% of the car market would be getting close to Apple's current Mac business. And I think they could get a lot more of that car market. 10% might be a big shot, but, you know, after a few years, if they can get a successful electric car on the market, I don't see why Apple couldn't make that kind of splash and that kind of impact. And that's a pretty good amount of revenue. Now, there is one big difference that I need to point out here, and that is that car margins are much thinner than what Apple is used to in terms of profit. So we're talking about revenue, but when it comes to profit, car margins are something like 3 to 15%. I saw some numbers in Forbes and some numbers over on Bloomberg. That seems to be the range depending upon the car manufacturer and the model and the make and things like that. It's probably higher for higher-end luxury-style cars, which would be, you know, part of the market that I think Apple would be going after. Think Tesla level, I would imagine. But that's far from the 30 to 45% profit margins that Apple is used to. And I doubt they could make that kind of margin on an automobile. So that has to go and factor into their decision to enter this market as well. It's going to be much harder to make those larger margins, I guess, unless they can really innovate on the technology side and bring the costs down. So who knows? But you look at all those things and it's like, well, maybe this isn't so crazy for Apple to enter the car market. And there's always the option to maybe partner with another company with the amount of cash on hand and the revenue. They could always just outright buy another company if they needed help. So I think it might is very likely happening. And, you know, Bloomberg reports that executives at Apple are supposedly pushing for their internal development teams to put together a product that they can actually start shipping and delivering to customers an electric vehicle in about 5 years. So that would be around 2020. So I guess if you're planning on buying one of those first Apple cars, maybe start socking away some money right now. I have no idea. No one's even talked about price point. I think it's way too early to tell. But I'm guessing we're talking in the luxury car range, you know, $50,000 to $70,000 to $100,000 for the first models that might be hitting the streets. But that's just purely my speculation. But if you think about Apple as a company and the kinds of technology they would be bringing to market, I think, you know, again, if you look at Tesla as a model, how Tesla launched is probably how Apple is going to launch their car and then eventually bring the costs down to more and more consumers, just like they did with the iPhone and the iPad and everything else that they've done over the years, even the iPod. You remember that first iPod and how expensive that five gigabytes of storage was? Was it gigabytes back then? I think that's right. So they bring out a product, shoot for the high end, and then slowly work their way down as the product matures. And that's been a great business model for Apple in the past, so why can't they apply that to cars? I think they can. Another technology that may be expanding is Touch ID. There's a rumor coming out of Taiwan claiming that the 12-inch Retina MacBook Air, and that's another rumored product that we've been talking about for a long time, so that doesn't exist as well, but they're saying that new model could have a Touch ID sensor built in right above the trackpad. And the idea, I guess, is that Apple hopes to make Apple Pay part of online web payments. You know, right now it's built in to retail stores, physical locations, as well as iOS applications. So you can use Apple Pay through an app, but you can't currently go to, say, Apple.com or Target.com's website and use Apple Pay. So if they could get Apple Pay technology built into Macs, and also they're saying the Magic Mouse and the trackpad, then potentially Apple could roll out a new payment system to maybe give things like Amazon's payment platform or Google Wallet, those types of online payment systems, a run for their money, PayPal as well. And I think that would be very cool to have Touch ID built into web interfaces. I mean, I'm a web developer, so why wouldn't I think that? But still, I think it makes a lot of sense. And as far as integrating it into Mac laptops and things like the Magic Trackpad, or maybe even, and no one said this yet, but I think it would make sense to also build Touch ID into the Apple wireless keyboard. I think a great location for it would be just around the power button. And I know, I think Apple's removed the power button from a lot of their laptop models. I think it's now where the eject key used to be on newer models. I have an older 15-inch MacBook Pro, and I still have the little power key up in the upper right. But I think that would be a perfect location to put a little Touch ID sensor. I don't know, maybe next to or right above the trackpad also makes sense because it's a little bit closer. But as far as the wireless keyboard or the Magic Trackpad, I think right around the little round power button on the side would be perfect. And you could put one on either side, so it'd be good for left-handed or right-handed folks. It's easy to kind of just reach around the side of the trackpad or the keyboard and just kind of rest your finger there, like your middle finger or maybe your ring finger, something like that. Just give it a try, and I think it works pretty well. So that's where I would do it, and you know, it kind of goes in line with the Touch ID sensor being around the home button on iOS devices. Same kind of aesthetic, same kind of feeling. But maybe a brand new location. We've also maybe heard that they've got some technology where they could integrate it right into the trackpad itself, which would be really cool. So you wouldn't really have a button or an area. You just kind of rest your finger on the trackpad and boom, it would activate Touch ID. So I think they have a few options as far as that goes, but I think it's not surprising that Apple wants to expand Touch ID beyond iOS devices and bring it over to the Mac. If you want to get an early look at the next version of iOS or the next iOS update, there's good news for you according to 9to5 Mac. It looks like Apple is going to, just like they did with OS X Yosemite, offer a beta program to the public. They're saying that Apple is planning to allow for public beta testing of the next version of iOS, as well as potentially future versions of iOS. The program is going to be run just like the Mac program through Apple's Appleseed program, and they will reportedly start with iOS 8.3 Beta 3, which is expected to be out sometime in mid-March. They currently have iOS 8.3 Beta 2 out in the developer program. They claim that, in addition, Apple will continue to do the public beta testing with iOS 9, which is expected to come out sometime mid-summer after its expected announcement at WWDC in June. As I said, those who are already currently in Apple's developer program did recently see a release of iOS Beta 8.3 Beta 2, as well as Mac OS 10 10.3. Both of those updates have Apple's new emoji in them. They've expanded the emoji set and included the new emoji skin modifiers, as well as added more diversity into the family emoji. So Apple trying to get a little bit more diverse with emoji icons. As far as other things that are in those new betas, iOS reportedly has fixed some CarPlay bugs, and Apple also brought Google, or support for Google's two-step verification to iOS, and added Apple Pay support for China UnionPay's network. And then there's also seven new languages for Siri. The languages include Russian, Danish, Dutch, Thai, Turkish, Swedish, and Portuguese. Over on the Mac side, 10.3.3, the biggest thing that it brought was the new Photos app. Now, it seems like we've talked about this a little bit because it was pretty big news when Apple launched the Photos app in the beta. It looks like the next version will have, finally, the Photos application built in. It's getting a lot of good buzz in terms of the user interface, the seamless transition over from iPhoto. Folks on the Aperture side may or may not be so happy about Photos because it doesn't have a lot of those pro features. And 10.3.3 also, just like iOS, did bring in support for Google's two-step verification if you're using Google accounts on your Mac. So that's kind of the latest happening with the iOS and OS X betas. And then finally in the news for this week, some updates for Apple Pay coming in Europe, possibly as early as mid-April. The good news over there is that supposedly Visa Europe has announced that its European contactless payment terminals will be getting support for tokenization, which is what is used by Apple Pay, by mid-April. Of course, if you live over in Europe, you know that you've had contactless payment terminals for a lot longer than the United States, but I've been told that in the U.S., the cards that work with Apple Pay at payment terminals have support for the tokenization, whereas over in Europe, the current contactless payment cards actually transmit the card data and details over to the terminal. So they're not using the tokenization system, which is why they are not currently compatible with Apple Pay. Although even that seems like a little bit of a misreporting, because we've heard from MacCast listeners, as well as seen other reports, that folks with U.S.-based cards that are on Apple Pay have been able to go over to terminals in Europe and use the Apple Pay system. So not really sure what's happening here, but supposedly, at least for Visa cards in Europe, they're going to be getting terminals with this tokenization support. And while Visa Europe has not confirmed that Apple will be using the new terminals and service with Apple Pay, Visa is an Apple Pay partner, so it's assumed that once these new terminals go into play, then Apple may be able to open up Apple Pay finally in Europe, at least for Visa. Apple's already been working with a number of banks over there, so they supposedly have bank partners on board. So bottom line is, it looks like you're getting closer to getting Apple Pay over in Europe. Another thing happening over across the pond is that Apple announced it plans to build two new data centers in Europe, both to host iCloud, iTunes, and other online services. One is going to be in Ireland, the other is going to be in Denmark, and just like their U.S. data centers, Apple does plan the facilities to be powered by 100% renewable energy. They also plan to have the data centers online in 2017, and both are going to be reportedly around 166,000 square meters in size. So two large data centers going into play for Apple over in Europe. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, if you're wanting to get a new iPhone or an iPad, or you know that new Apple Watch is right around the corner, maybe you want to secure some cash right now for that purchase, Gazelle actually wants to buy your current devices. They want to buy your old stuff. So that old iPhone or iPad that you have lying around just sitting there from when you upgraded, that is a perfect device to go on Gazelle and see what it's worth. And it's cool because it's a great and easy way to get cash to help you upgrade your stuff or purchase new stuff. And what I love about Gazelle is it's all upfront. They give you a fair upfront offer. They'll even buy broken devices, so don't worry if you've got damage or broken stuff. They will take that too, and they make the process so completely easy and simple and hassle-free. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You find your item, you answer a few questions about condition, some of the accessories you have, things like that, and right there on screen, you get a risk-free offer for your gadgets, and they even have free shipping, and in many cases, will provide you a box to make the process even easier. And then once you've sent in your device, you get paid fast by check, by PayPal. You can even get an extra 5% on your offer if you choose to get paid by Amazon gift card. That's actually my favorite way to get paid because I use Amazon all the time. And the offer process takes less than a minute. So do it today because every day you wait, your gadgets will lose value. So lock in your price now. And you can lock in the price and maybe even get your new device before you actually have to send the old one in. It's a really great service. Gazelle has handled over 2 million trade-ins. They've paid out over $175 million to customers, and 90% of folks using Gazelle report having an excellent experience. And you can include me in that group. I've sold several items through Gazelle, and I absolutely love it. So what are you waiting for? Take a minute. Find out what your used iPhone, iPad, Mac or other products are worth by going to gazelle.com, and a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. I think we've talked about this subject for the past few years now, and that is Apple's MacBook Pro display issues. They have had issues with graphics cards on the, I know it's at least as far back as maybe the 2008 MacBook Pros. I had issues on my 2010 MacBook Pro that were ultimately fixed and replaced by Apple, I think, 3 or 4 times. And then they finally replaced my machine with the 2011 MacBook Pro, which is the one that I have now, 15-inch MacBook Pro. And it has had 3 logic board replacements to deal with a graphics issue. And for years, many of us had been complaining and saying that there was something seriously wrong with the MacBook Pro lineup and its graphics card. If you were under AppleCare, you were often well taken care of. If you didn't have AppleCare, it was a whole different experience. And I know we've talked about this on the show for the last few years. Well, finally, Apple has acknowledged the issue, at least with the latest MacBook Pros, and they launched a repair program to fix affected machines. These are machines sold between February 2011 and February 2013 that are having video issues. So if you've suffered from this problem, I'll have a link in the show notes at maccast.com. You can click through to Apple's new MacBook repair program, and you can check your device there. There's a check your coverage tool, and you can see if your unit is affected, and if it is, then contact AppleCare support or head to your Genius Bar. But basically what happens is you'll start to get weird video issues, either distorted video or no video or even unexpected system restarts. If that's been happening to you and you're the owner of a 15-inch or a 17-inch MacBook Pro, you might want to check and make sure that your machine is covered and get it addressed. And again, these are models manufactured in 2011. I guess it also can impact the 15-inch Retina MacBook Pro models made between 2012 and early 2013. And like I said, I know it goes back further than this. Unfortunately, Apple is only offering this current extended coverage program for models 2011 and later. If you paid for a repair on one of the affected units, you should also have received an email about that, and you should be getting a reimbursement from Apple. If you haven't and you repaired your machine and paid for it and it's one of the affected models, then you want to make sure that you contact Apple so that you can get a refund, you know, just in case you moved or things had changed or for whatever reason they didn't have a proper record to contact you at. But Apple is offering this repair program through February 27th, 2016, or 3 years from the MacBook Pro's original sale date. So as long as you're within the 3 years, then you should be covered under this program. If you're outside that three-year range, then there is no extra coverage provided, which is probably why those older units are not covered under this extension program. Apple considers those outside the realm of the program. Now, because the problem has been around for so long, I think they ultimately should extend it, and I hope that they do extend it to those older models because I think there was a flaw. Some have alleged, and I think there's been class action lawsuits, the effect that Apple was aware of the issue. I'm not entirely convinced that they knew as they were shipping units out that there was a problem. I think as the years went by and they started to get more and more incidents, I think they became aware of the problem. But at that point, I'm not sure, you know, beyond doing an extended repair program, what they could have done. So anyway, it's good news. It's some progress made on this front, and I wanted to let you know about it. If you've ever had a problem with the storage space running out on your Mac, it's very likely that one of the culprits is your media files, specifically your iTunes media library. Also, if you do a lot of video or photos, those can take up space. But many of us run into the issue where our iTunes library grows to such an unmanageable size that it really doesn't fit on our internal drive anymore. Dustin is just like the rest of us, and he's been having to deal with and manage his ever-growing media library and recently decided to move the iTunes media folder to an external drive to accommodate all that. You know, with HD movies, especially all the extras that are now included, we've got higher and higher bitrate music. It can get crowded, and especially if you have one of the newer Mac models that's using flash-based storage, we actually now get less storage than we had. So Mac's built-in storage, the built-in storage on Macs is becoming smaller, not larger, unfortunately. I think given time, that'll eventually change and we'll get back up to, you know, 1 terabyte, 2 terabytes of storage that's at an affordable price in the flash realm. But today, flash costs more than spinning drives. So a lot of us turn to using an external storage device to actually accommodate that growing library. But if you've made this transition and you're storing your media on an external drive, there is a thing that can happen to you when you're not connected to that external drive. So especially if you have a notebook or a laptop and you're taking that with you, you may leave the iTunes media drive at home. And I, for example, use a 2 terabyte USB portable drive for my iTunes library, and I specifically got a bus-powered portable so that I could take it with me. But even sometimes I don't, and I don't do that. So what happens is if you don't have your media drive with you and you launch iTunes, it's still going to launch, it's still going to function, you're still going to see all of your media files there because we're only talking, your library there, so you'll be able to see all of the music and movies and TV shows and stuff like that in iTunes. But obviously, because you don't have the actual files, the media, the stuff that's in the media folder, it's not necessarily going to play. But because iTunes will, when you first launch it, go out and try and find that drive, it has a default behavior when it can't find it. What it does is it reverts back to the default iTunes media folder location, which is in your home folder and the music folder inside iTunes, the iTunes media folder. And the reason it does that is because imagine you're out and about, or maybe you've gone on vacation and now you've launched iTunes and you want to buy a movie or a TV show, or you buy some new music, or maybe you want to update your podcasts. Well, where are those things going to go when they get downloaded? They're going to get downloaded onto your internal drive. So now that's a good thing because you can continue to work and make purchases and use iTunes and what have you, download podcasts, but it does create this problem that Dustin was running into, that when you return home or whenever you reconnect to that external drive, that external location, now you have some of your media files stored locally. You have other media files stored on that external, and iTunes really doesn't, the app itself, when you're in there looking at your media, it doesn't really indicate which is where, and it can get very confusing. And if you're like me, you want to have all of your media in a single location. You like that. And Dustin emailed me, and Dustin, it sounds like you're just like that as well. So how do you resolve it was the question Dustin asked me. You know, how do you get all your media consolidated back together? Because one thought you might immediately have is, well, you know, if I just simply drag the files from the local iTunes media folder and put them over to the external, good, I'll be good to go. It'll all be on the external drive. But the problem there is that your iTunes library file, the thing that tells iTunes where all of those files are, won't be updated. It won't know how to find that media. If you leave the copies on the internal and have the copies on the external, you'll be fine because it's still going to pull from the internal drive. But say you move them over and then you delete all the files that are on the internal drive in the iTunes media folder, then you're going to have broken links and iTunes is going to pop up an alert. It's going to say, hey, where are these files? I don't know where they are. And then you'll repoint them and then you can update your library. But that's cumbersome. It takes time. So another option is you drag the files and folders from the internal drive location. So the music folder, iTunes, iTunes media, you drag those and you drop them onto back into iTunes. If you have iTunes set up to manage and copy your media, then it is going to copy that media. It's going to put it on the external drive and it's going to update the library files. So good, you'll be up and running again. But once again, that's pretty cumbersome. And the other thing is as Dustin found out, it doesn't work for all of your files. For example, podcasts usually don't work well that way. Also, if you have apps, so maybe you ran some app updates when you were disconnected from your external media folder, those app updates are going to be on that local drive, and you might get something like an unknown error minus 50, which, Dustin, you let me know that you did get. So how do we do this? What's sort of the right, correct iTunes Apple-y way of doing this is really what it comes down to. And luckily, it's built in. There's an easy way to resync your data over to that external location, get everything updated, get all the files moved over, and you won't have to worry about it. The key is you don't want to do any of these manual operations. You want to have iTunes do the work for you. So here's how you do it. First, make sure that iTunes has been quit and, of course, that you're reconnected to your external drive with your iTunes media on it. And iTunes is pretty smart. Once it will always try to find that default external media file location, and then only if it doesn't find it, default back to the internal. So when you get reconnected, it will still try to go out the first time you launch iTunes and reconnect to that external library. So make sure you've quit down iTunes, reconnect the external drive with your iTunes media folder on it, then launch iTunes, and then you can open up the iTunes preferences and then go under the advanced tab and just double check and make sure the iTunes media folder location is correct. It should be pointing to that external volume. If not, you can use the change button to fix it, but it should do it by default. Then, still in the advanced tab, what you want to do is check to make sure that the keep iTunes media folder organized option is checked on, and also the copy files to iTunes media folder when adding to library is checked. Make sure both those are checked and then click OK. Now what you're going to do is you're going to go under the file menu. You're going to go to choose to library and then under organize library and select that. And when you do that, it will pop up a little dialogue and there'll be a checkbox that says consolidate files. Check that on and click OK. And if you notice a little message under there, what'll happen after clicking OK is it's going to do exactly what it says, which is that it will take all the media files used by iTunes and copy them into your chosen media folder location. So in this case, it's going to take everything that's in the internal drive's iTunes media files location, and it's going to copy them over to that external. And you'll see a progress, so just wait for that to finish. And then what you can do is you can look in the folder on the external drive to confirm that all the files have been copied over. The good part of doing it this way is that, once again, all those references in your library files will also be updated to point to the correct media folder location. So you're not going to have any playback issues moving forward. And so once you've confirmed that the files have moved over and that you can play them in iTunes and everything's working to your satisfaction, then if you want, you can go back into the local iTunes media folder on your main hard drive and clean that up. You can delete any leftover files or downloaded apps or podcasts or what have you and clear that out. So, Dustin, I hope this clears things up for you gets your iTunes library reorganized. But it's a pretty straightforward process, although it's not clear until you really have someone explain it to you. It took me a while to figure this one out. Apple actually has some helpful tech support articles on this, but now you all know what to do. So there you go. Another thing that can get sort of messed up on your Mac and sometimes be a little bit confusing are your contacts, especially if you're syncing or maybe even syncing from multiple locations, syncing to multiple devices. Anytime you're syncing stuff, I think things can potentially go south and go wrong. And contacts is one of those areas that's particularly tricky. And this week I received this question from Sebastian.
Hi, Adam. It's Sebastian from Germany. Having discovered that not all of my contacts on my iPhone are synced over iCloud to my iPad or to my Mac, I went into the settings on my iPhone under Mail, Contacts and Calendars, and there is a contact section. I discovered that the default account was actually not iCloud, but on my iPhone. So I changed that. So I clicked on iCloud, and however, a few of the contacts that I have created are still not synced. So is there a way for the contacts that were created while I had this old setting on to automatically sync them to iCloud, or do I have to each and every one of them sent them as a vCard by email and import them? That would be quite a hassle, as it's quite a lot of contacts that are only on my iPhone. I would very much appreciate if you had some idea how to fix that issue. I very much like your new segment, Things of the Moment. I hope you'll keep that up. Thanks. It's Sebastian. Bye.
Hey, Sebastian. Yeah, I think I can help you out with that. I think I know what may be going on there. And also, yes, I do have a thing of the moment for this episode. So stay tuned for that. As long as I have something to something cool, something new, I will continue to share those with you. But getting back to your contacts question. So I think what's going on is that before you used iCloud syncing, or before we had iCloud syncing, we would have contacts and calendars and stuff on our Mac, and we would sync those via iTunes to our devices. If you think way, way back to the iPod days when we were all syncing that stuff to iPods, that was really the only way to do it. We didn't have any cloud connectivity. And then iCloud and .Mac and all that stuff came along, and then we started syncing through the cloud. And so what would inevitably happen is you can end up with kind of two locations, and some people almost look at them like duplicates of contacts on their Macs. You'll have the stuff that's stored locally just on that Mac, and then you'll have the stuff that's synced via iCloud. And I forget how long ago, I think it was a couple versions back in contacts, Apple started to indicate this when you went into the contacts app. You kind of had these sections, and you still have them now because you may have also multiple sources that you're syncing from. So if you have Google or Yahoo or LinkedIn, you'll see sections for those as well. But you'll have an iCloud section and maybe a LinkedIn section, and you may or may not, and it sounds like in your case you do, still have an On My Mac section. And just like in the old days, I'm pretty sure the On My Mac section, the only way to get those to sync to your device is to set that up manually in iTunes. And I'll give you more on that in a second. But basically what you are asking is, how do I get the contacts that are local into iCloud so that I can sync them? And your solution that you sort of proposed at the end is a valid one. You could export those local contacts as vCards and then re-import them in, putting them into the iCloud section. But there's actually a little bit easier way. Now, I'm going to offer up the solution to you, but I also want to point out to anyone else who might be listening and trying to follow along that I looked into my contacts both in OS X Yosemite and in iOS 8. And going into the contacts apps in either platform, I could no longer see an on my Mac category or on my iPhone category for myself. Now, I don't know if that's because I moved everything into iCloud or that I don't have the iTunes local syncing turned on in my iTunes. And that's maybe why I'm not seeing those groups, but I didn't discover them. But I do know that they existed a long time ago for me. So I'm probably missing a setting or some switch or something. But and if I am, please let me know and let me know how I get that back. But I think I get it back by just turning on the syncing in iTunes. But for you, Sebastian, it should be pretty easy to clean things up. So as you've already done, the first thing you're going to want to do is make sure that you set the default location for creating new contacts on your iOS devices and your Macs, that default is into iCloud. iCloud's the thing that's going to handle the syncing and make sure that everything stays in sync. So I'd check the setting both on your Mac in OS X and on iOS. Then, and I'm not sure if you can do this on iOS, what you want to do is move the contacts from the On My Mac section over to the iCloud section. Again, I didn't see any way to do this on iOS. So if you have On My iPhone, I didn't see a way to move those contacts in the contacts app on iOS over to iCloud. But you can very easily do it on the Mac. And the way you do it is you open up the contacts app and then just make sure that you can see the groups sidebar. If you don't, go under the view menu and say show groups. And then in the sidebar on the left, scroll down and find that On My Mac section. And then select the All On My Mac to view all of the contacts that are saved locally on your Mac. I'm assuming these are going to match the ones that you have in the On My iPhone section, the ones that you commented to say aren't syncing for you. And then what you'll do is you'll select all those contacts from the All On My Mac section and then just simply drag them over and drop them on the All iCloud section or group in the sidebar under iCloud. And that will move them over and put them into the iCloud section. I don't know if it copies. I think it copies. I'm not sure that it takes them out of the On My Mac, but it would put them into iCloud. And then iCloud should start doing its thing and sync all those up to all of your iOS devices. And then you should be good to go. And then you can confirm that you have the records in iCloud and double check them, make sure they're all okay. And then if you want, you could go back and clean up the On My Mac ones and get rid of those. So that should copy everything over. And you know, I think this would even work if you didn't use iCloud. If you were using another service like Google or Yahoo, you could copy those contacts from On My Mac over to Google or over to Yahoo or however you want. So adjust accordingly for whatever sync service you might be using. And as far as, again, how those got to the On My Phone section in the first place, I can only speculate here. But I think it's because of the manual syncing through iTunes. So what I would do is connect your device to your Mac using the Lightning cable, or if you're on an older device, the 30-pin cable. Then open up iTunes and select the device. And then once you have the device selected in iTunes, click on the info section and check the sync contacts option. If that is checked on, and I'm going to make the assumption that it is, then that's what's causing your contacts to sync directly to the On My Phone section. So what you can do is once you've, again, confirmed that everything's syncing up through iCloud, you can simply uncheck that. And I think when you do that, the next time you sync, the whole On My Device category will simply go away because you're not syncing that stuff over locally or directly. So I hope that helps you out. I hope that solves your problem. If it doesn't, if that wasn't it, follow up with me, let me know, and we'll try and get some other solutions out there. And if you happen to know that I somehow got this wrong, let me know that as well. Just shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. So before we get to the thing of the moment, I have one more thing for you. We recently had been discussing reselling iOS devices and how it's important now because of things like Find My iPhone and Activation Lock and iCloud that before you sell your device, you disconnect your device from the iCloud services, you turn off Find My iPhone, which disables the Activation Lock, and get rid of all that stuff so that when the buyer actually receives your device, they can actually activate it and use it, and they don't end up getting weird things like suddenly they're getting your iMessages and what have you. Well, after mentioning this, I got an email from Aaron who came up with a rather creative way of being able to sell your device but not having to remove it from Find My iPhone until the buyer actually receives it. And why would you want to do this? Because as we had been discussing earlier, it could cause all kinds of problems for the buyer. Well, as Aaron pointed out, if you ship the device and, for example, say it's lost in the mail, or in his case, because he's in the UK, I believe, the post, you will no longer have the activation lock protection in place, nor will you be able to use Find My iPhone to track the device, right? You'll have no idea where it is or where it went. So he came up with what I thought was a rather creative solution, and I wanted to share this with you. Because they are free, he said, why not create a temporary iCloud account? And I think he actually did this when he sold one of his devices. Create a temporary iCloud account and activate the device under that account. And also set up a passcode lock and then share the device login, the iCloud login credentials, and the passcode lock of the temporary iCloud account with the buyer. So now you both know this sort of temporary throwaway account information. And then before you ship the device, you can use Find My iPhone to put the device in lost mode, which is going to lock it out until the passcode lock is put in. Which is genius because the nice thing is when it's in lost mode, you can actually still track it. So that means you can keep the tracking, you can keep the activation lock abilities. So if somehow it gets lost in the mail, somebody else who's not the buyer or not you isn't going to be able to reactivate it. And another nice thing is when it's in lost mode, once it's received and the passcode is put in, you get a ping, you get an email notification saying, hey, the device was found, we found it. So you would have kind of this confirmation that it got to the buyer. Pretty smart, right? I thought that was a pretty good idea. And then, so once the buyer receives it, they can put in the passcode, they can remove the temporary iCloud account, which thereby removes the activation lock, and then they can set it up on their account, reactivate it, and use it and what have you. And another cool thing that Aaron said he did when he was shipping his was he actually left it on. So as it was traveling to the destination, it was pinging various open Wi-Fi hotspots and he could actually see the progress through the post. He could see the progress through the mail and see where it was going. He said it lasted for about 3 days. The battery didn't die in transit. And I thought that was pretty neat as well. So nice little trick. And I don't know why I hadn't thought of that before, but I think that's a good way to handle it, Aaron. So thanks for sharing that with us. And now let's talk thing of the moment. This one is actually pretty cool. Being a podcaster, I am into mics and audio. And one of the things that I've been struggling with for a while is putting together a mobile system, specifically that something that I could use with the iPad and maybe not always have to take my laptop with me when I record. Right now, when I travel, I take my laptop, I take my portable digital audio recorder, which is a Zoom H4N handy recorder and a pretty big microphone and kind of more gear than I would like. So I wanted something a little bit more portable. And Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer, we happened to be talking about something and I mentioned this and he said, hey, I have the perfect mic for you. It's a cardioid dynamic mic, USB and XLR. And it's portable and it's from Audio Technica. And I thought, oh, that's awesome because my studio mic is actually an Audio Technica AT2020. So this mic that is my thing of the moment for this week is the Audio Technica AT2005 USB. And if you heard my last podcast, the Three Amigos podcast, or the Amigos podcast rather, any of the audio that wasn't the recorded part with Victor and Dave, that was recorded in my hotel room in Florida as I was traveling about a week and a half ago with the AT2005. So you can kind of hear the audio quality. And what's neat is because it has both USB and XLR connectors, You're able to connect it right up to your Mac via USB, but if you needed to go into a soundboard or a mixing board, you could do that as well with the XLR cable. And when you're connected with USB, it's really great because GarageBand on the Mac just sees it as a mic input. And so you can select that as the mic input and record directly into GarageBand, into your project file. And of course, this would work with any app that can see a mic input. So that would be Skype, any other apps you might use when you're doing podcast recording. And for the iPad, you can just simply use a Lightning to USB adapter and plug that right into your iPhone or iPad. No extra power needed. It gets all of its power that it needs from USB because it's a dynamic mic. It doesn't need a lot of juice. And so you have no problems there. And another nice feature that it has is there's a headphone jack with a volume control right on the mic. So you can monitor right off the mic without having any latency. Sometimes with USB audio recording, there can be a little bit of latency if you're trying to monitor through the Mac. So you kind of get this delayed sound in your headphones. With this, you can plug right in and you can hear the audio that's being picked up directly from the mic. It's also a little bit better for monitoring, and it's great for Skype recording as well because you can also set that mic input as the audio out. So you can have the sound from your Mac flowing out through the USB audio interface in the mic and back into your headphones. So you can monitor and listen and do everything that you need to do right from the little USB mic. And it's great. The kit includes everything you need. There's a little fold-out desktop tripod, a microphone clip, the XLR cable and the USB cables included, and you get this cool little zipper case that you everything fits into, so you can just zip it all up and toss it in your bag. And then the most amazing thing or part of all of this is the price. $50 to $65 US online on Amazon. I think they list the retail value at $149, but you can very easily find it between $50 and $65. And it's just a killer deal if you're looking for a good portable audio recording rig for your Mac, for your iOS devices. Grab this one, the Audio-Technica AT2005 USB, and that is the thing of the moment for this week. And I guess I lied. I have one more little item in the MacCast for you today. Apple updated its website recently. It's actually on the front page right now. I don't know how long it's going to stay there, but they're highlighting iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus photography, something they're calling the iPhone World Gallery. And it's these amazing images taken by customers all over the world using their iPhone 6 and 6 Pluses. And it lists the apps that they use for creating the images and taking the images, and has a lot of a little bit of information. I shouldn't say a lot of information, but a little information, a little backstory of the photo and some photo tips and suggestions in terms of how to take better shots and composing and stuff like that. Real handy little guide and just some amazing images. So if you haven't been over to Apple's website, you should jump over and check that out. And I will, of course, have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, and PDF Pen Scan Plus on iOS. You can find more information and details on all of their great software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free 10-day trial to lynda.com by going to lynda.com/MacCast. That's lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. You'll find them at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, I always welcome those. I especially welcome audio comments. We will, as you have heard, play those on the show from time to time. You can send those, just attach an audio file or just shoot me an email to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. And if you'd prefer Skype, you can leave voicemail there. My Skype address is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. That's a great place to ask questions and get answers from other members of the MacCast community. There's a great sort of group of people that hang out over there and answer questions, really smart technical guys. So if you haven't taken advantage of that resource, please do, forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online between shows, I'm on social media, Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. There's also the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. And we do have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus and you will find us there. So whatever your social media weapon of choice is, we have a solution for you. Look forward to seeing you online, but until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.